Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
You'll love Apple Card. It's everything a credit card should be and more. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, which can automatically earn interest when you open a high-yield savings account through Apple Card. Apply for Apple Card in the Wallet app. Subject to credit approval, savings is available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Apple Card and savings by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, member FDIC. Terms and more at applecard.com.
This episode is sponsored in part by AutoTrader. Credit scores, down payments, interest rates, car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. Crunch your numbers and get your personalized results so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. I've used Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader, and I know that next time I'm in the market for a car, I will use it again. Instead of racking my brain and mashing a calculator, I can speed things up and find the right deal for me. So hit the road and leave your calculator at home. Find your next car on AutoTrader.com. How I Built This is proudly sponsored by Amica Insurance. Amica understands how important it is to protect the things that matter most to you. So they'll put in the time to make sure you're taken care of, whether it's talking through all the details of your policy or following up after a claim. Your auto, home, and life insurance are more than just policies. They're protection for the life you've built. As Amica says, empathy is our best policy. Go to amica.com and get a quote today. Hey, really quick before we start the show, we have an announcement about a really exciting new thing we're launching, a newsletter. And like our show, the newsletter is designed to be interesting, informative, inspiring, and most importantly, fun. It's 100% free, and to sign up, just visit guyraz.com. That's guyraz.com. Once you have 150, 200, 300 people in line, I mean, those people were not going to get a cronut.
No, for sure.
Like, only 50 people were going to get one.
Yeah, maybe, and we had no rules. In the beginning, people were buying a dozen, we were buying two dozen, and then we were, like, left with, like, nothing. But it was just, like, insane because we couldn't make enough.
I mean, I remember this was covered on, like, national news. You had, like, camera crews outside the bakery.
Many, many days where I had, like, reporters reporting live. You're right in front of the bakery.
Live from the Cronut Bakery.
Because it was madness, so I had to hire security to manage the line. And all I felt like, it's a nightmare.
Welcome to How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how an arranged marriage between a donut and a croissant led to a perfect pastry called the Cronut and made Dominique Ansel's bakery one of the best known in the world. There's an inherent tension between making an exceptional product and running a scalable business. A really well-made, high-quality product usually takes time, and it takes expensive materials, and it's hard to scale, all of which is perfectly fine. Scale doesn't have to be the goal. The goal is to build a sustainable and profitable business, which is what Dominique Ansel's done, despite the temptation and the pressure to expand and go big. Now, you may not immediately recognize his name, but you will know the product he's most famous for. It's what got him global attention for a period of time starting in 2013. Dominique invented the Cronut, a cross between a croissant and a donut. For months and even years after its release, people would line up around the block in front of Dominique's bakery in New York just to get their hands on one. Soon after, investors and other folks with dollar signs in their eyes approached Dominique. Expand, they said. Build a Cronut factory. But Dominique resisted that. And today, he's built a brand around just 3 bakeries and a mail-order business. It's profitable, sustainable, and most importantly to Dominique, it doesn't cut corners when it comes to quality. And he's now widely considered to be one of the best pastry chefs in the world. But over the years, Dominique's also learned how to be a businessman, how to splurge on things like butter and flour, but cut costs by learning how to fix generators and toilets himself. For a guy who would be an honored guest at a Michelin-starred restaurant these days, Dominique Ancel didn't grow up in that world. In fact, he grew up in a working-class home in a small town in northern France where his dad worked in a factory.
I grew up in one of the poorest towns in France. I grew up in one of the poorest neighborhoods in that town. And I remember growing up, I remember like food was something interesting to me because I don't think my family was the best at managing money. Very often, like, you know, the second or third week of the month, we had nothing left. And so I was not starving, but it was not easy to come by. And I was not eating like the best food either. And my mom was actually a terrible cook. It was so bad. And I think that's probably what inspired me to get to the kitchen. Mm. So, you know, when I was 15 years old, I was told that, you know, I need to get a job. I couldn't like keep going to university or anything like this. It was not accessible to me.
You were not going to go to university. That was not your...
No.
Yeah.
That was not an option. But, you know, my parents never gave me any like guidance. They were okay with anything I wanted to do. So early on, I decided, you know, I figured out that I was on my own and I had to make my own choice, my own research. And I decided to, you know, to find a humble job and I started in the kitchen.
This was at a local restaurant you were working at?
A small local restaurant. That was a chef, savory chef.
Yeah.
So I did this program that was 3 weeks with an employer and 1 week at school.
It was like a culinary school.
Learning culinary, yeah. But my first year was just like miserable. I hated everything about it. The people I was working with were just terrible. Abusive in every sense of the way. So they will like cut me with knives.
Cut you with knives?
Yeah. Just for fun, look at me laughing.
Wow.
The sous chef there was like smoking weed during service. He would like heat up the spatula by the stove, remove it from the stove, and I would come just sear my arm with a hot spatula.
Wow, that sounds like hell.
So this, you know, like this is hell. This is horrible. I would go to work every day, every morning, waking up with like a knot in my stomach in fear of going to work. They'll insult me, you know, slap me in the back of the head, like punch me in the shoulder, like all day long. And luckily, a year later, the restaurant was sold to a younger chef. And he was tough, but he was a much better person. He started showing me and teaching me, showing me how to appreciate cooking, buying nice ingredients, and teach me how to work with them, how to like cook it. And I started like developing the care and the love for what I was doing.
So this really was kind of the beginning of your education. Clearly, you were on a track to become a chef. This is what you were learning what to do. And what was it about that life that appealed to you? Did you like, I don't know, did you like the idea of making something and watching people eat it? Did you like the experimentation?
So at that time, I had no choice. I had no choice to get a little bit of money to support the family. And I had no options to quit. Quitting was not an option.
You needed the check.
You need it. You stick with it no matter what.
But did you find that you had a little bit of a talent for cooking? Did you, anybody in that kitchen ever say, you know, you're a little bit better than the other trainees?
Back then, no. You know, it took time for me to appreciate what I was doing and then loving it. And I think when you reach that level of like loving what you do, this is where you really like blossom and you really like explore like cooking at a different level.
Got it. Okay. So you basically do that for, I think, about 3 years.
Yes.
And I guess we should make this distinction because most chefs do not know how to do pastry. And a lot of pastry people, they know how to cook, but not as well because it's like if you're in baseball and you're a pitcher, you can hit, but you don't really know how to hit because you're not practicing hitting anymore. You're just pitching. It's yes. like, right?
So, doing my training in the beginning stage. So I did 2 years in a restaurant with the same program, and then I did 1 year in a bakery. So that was my first taste of learning baking. So I did work in a bakery for a year.
I see. Okay. You did. But what was it about baking and pastry that you thought, this is the direction I want to go into? Because it's really one or the other. If you're going to choose cooking, that's one direction. If you're going to choose pastry, that's the other direction.
I think I still love both. I think cooking is more like feeling, tasting, seasoning, and baking is more like scientific. It's precise.
It's science. It's weighing. It's
also art. It's also like creating, building from scratch. I think I was a lot more attracted to like those steps of building, understanding the science and the precision of it. This was more matching my personality and what I wanted to do.
I wonder, I mean, because you basically started to drop your resume off at different bakeries.
Yeah, I decided to go to Paris, the capital from the countryside, and to find a job in a bakery. So I knew nobody. I had no connections, no cell phone at the time. I still had this like big, like huge map. And I was completely lost in the city. I had printed out a few resumes and I would drive around for like hours, like for many days. And every time I would see a bakery, I'll randomly like park the car, run inside, drop off my resume. Mm. And I found a job at Pâtisserie Pelletier, which was at the time one of the oldest pastry shop in Paris. I will always remember this job because to this day, I think there I made one of the most beautiful croissants I've ever made.
Wow.
And I can say that I have no shame to say it. I still like perfect my croissant every day. But the way we were making it. So instead of, you know, putting the butter inside the dough, we used to cream the butter in our hands. So it has to be pliable, but not too soft, not too hard.
Not melty.
And you will spread it with your fingertip inside the dough in two additions.
Wow.
And only a few people can do this because most people's hands are too hot to handle the butter.
Yeah.
But I've always have cold hands my entire life.
You have cold hands.
I have cold hands, which is good for chocolate and like dough.
Yeah. How long, by the way, does it take to make one croissant from the moment you start to pour the ingredients to the time that it's sold in the display case?
It takes 3 days.
3 days.
So the first day we mix the dough, and then you have to let it ferment, remove all the gas that from the fermentation, let it chill. The next day you incorporate the butter and you give all the folds, and then you cut it, you roll it, and day three you have to let it rest overnight. And day three you ferment it again and then you bake it.
That's unbelievable. People don't know this. They don't realize that something that takes you like 45 seconds to eat took 3 days to make.
Yeah, it's a real craft, you know. That's one of my saddest things, you know, growing up in France. I've been to like lots of bakeries. I love bread. By nature in France, people think that bread should be cheap.
Yeah.
And I you know, I don't believe in that. I believe bread should be a little bit more expensive. It takes so much labor and so much time.
Yeah. All right. So from you work at this bakery, this pâtisserie, Pelletier for a year. Okay. You move on to Fauchon, which is now, if you go to Paris, there are a bunch of locations, and it was, I think when you worked there, it was just maybe one location.
Yeah,
and it was,
actually, they filed for bankruptcy, unfortunately, a few years ago, and they closed everything now. It was one of the most prestigious like bakery and retail, and like it's like the most high end.
They sold chocolates, right? They sold all kinds of things:
fruits, vegetables, spices, coffee from all around the world.
And you were hired to be. I mean, this was when you were hired. You were just hired as another pastry chef.
So yes, I left Pelletier after 1 year, and I walked into Fauchon because I knew it was one of the best bakery. I was a seasonal worker, so I was hired for the holidays from September to December. So I was one of 30 people hired, actually. And towards mid-December, they called us all in a room. They told us they will keep one person only, and they had chosen me to stay. So I was supposed to stay for 4 months. I ended up staying for close to 8 years.
Wow.
And when I was there, I was after 6 months, I was promoted as the chef de partie. And then quickly into sous chef, I was 24. They bought like another like 10 locations. I was in the kitchen. I was in charge of a team of over 100 people.
So you were just handed this team of 100 people. How did you even know how to manage 100?
I mean, I was not by myself. It was another chef.
Yeah.
Plus a lot of other sous chef, and was one of the sous chef. So I was one of the youngest in the kitchen, actually.
Yeah, because by the time you were 24, I mean, you already had 8 years of experience in a kitchen under your belt. So you were very experienced. You were very young. But how did you just learn how to be a boss?
I mean, you know, I think my entire life observing was something that I was very good at. So growing up, I always observed my siblings, you know, all the things they were doing, all the bad things, all the good things. I always pick and choose what I want to do. And I think I was the same in the kitchen. So I've seen a lot of people, you know, I've seen a lot of chefs yelling and screaming. And it always made me feel uncomfortable. I see them putting pressure on people. I see them like, that was not my style.
You were rising up the ranks at Fauchon, right? Did you ever, while you were there, think, okay, eventually I got to start my own thing? Or were you just happy working there and being a part of that company?
I think deep inside, since I started, I always wanted to do my own thing. I had some up and down into like opening the business. Mostly, looking back, I was scared of the financial aspect.
Yeah.
I was always scared like how much it would cost, how much risk it would be for my life, and spending too much and taking risks. But deep inside, I always wanted to open my own thing.
And I guess we should mention that in France, and in many countries, it's not like in the U.S. where you could just declare bankruptcy and move on. Like, if you start a business and it goes bankrupt, you're saddled with that debt.
Yeah, you are, yes. You have to pay for it.
And that's why there's fewer risk-taking. I mean, there's just less risk-taking. I mean, I'm not saying that declaring bankruptcy is a good thing, but one of the arguments as to why there's more business innovation in the U.S. is because of bankruptcy. Like, you could take the risk.
Yeah, and you can still do it in France, you know, declare bankruptcy for a company, but there's a lot of like things that are attached to you personally.
Right.
And that is, it's hard to get out of.
Yeah. All right. So you're working your way up at Fauchon, and you eventually get promoted to like corporate pastry chef, which I guess means that you start traveling around the world and sort of helping them to develop new stores in other cities.
Yes.
And then with all that travel comes this really major turning point in 2006. You get a call from Daniel Boulud, who was and is one of the most famous chefs in New York City and even around the world. He calls you and he says, "Hey, I'm looking for a pastry chef." How did you even get on his radar?
So we had some friends in common. They had mentioned my name and gave my number, and Daniel just calls me out of the blue and tells me about, you know, restaurant Daniel and how he's interested. He's in my resume and he wants to talk to me. And I did a little bit of research, of course, about Daniel, the restaurant, what he was doing. I love New York. I had visited before. And before I went to Daniel, a lot of people told me, you know what, it's going to be tough. He has high expectation. It's a very difficult job. And the more I would hear this, the more it would make me like want to do it. So Daniel invited me to come to New York for a few days to do a tasting for him and to meet and to see the restaurant. And I had prepared probably, I think it was like 4 or 5 desserts plus a cake, some viennoiserie, some petit four. So I remember like he was sitting down on table. So I dropped the first desserts, come back, clean up, drop the second dessert. And I was standing next to him and he looked up and was like, "So when can you start?" I was like, "Excuse me."
After the second dessert.
And then he offered me a job right here and there. And then I know that, you know, 8 weeks later, I came to New York with 2 suitcases and I took a small apartment in Queens and I started working at Daniel.
Wow. So, I mean, this is like 2006. You were 28. This is like the beginning of the heyday. This is still before, I think, the Michelin Guide came to New York. It would come within a couple of years. But this was certainly, I mean, this was like about as good as it gets in New York City. What was your charge? Were you told, "Hey, just knock people out"? work on things that's just going to blow their mind?
No, I had no specific assignments, just to follow the style of cooking and make some good desserts. I have to admit, at the time, I was very nervous because coming from Fauchon, managing 100, 120 people in the kitchen to managing 10 people at Daniel, piece of cake.
Yeah.
But add the cultural difference, add the restaurant setting, add the language barrier, add all of this, that makes it like super challenging.
A pressure cooker, right? Also because they were, I mean, I think 3 years after you arrived, they won 3 Michelin stars. But I imagine that that's actually when the pressure really kind of goes up a notch, because you need to maintain that level of quality and service.
Absolutely. It's a lot of pressure. And one of the first things that Daniel say to all of us, and I always remember, I've heard it before, but that's the first thing he say that 3 Michelin star, it's hard to earn. 3 Michelin star is like much harder to keep.
Yes. Yeah. You end up spending about 5.5 years there. At what point did you in your mind start to think, because the next thing that would happen is you would leave and start your own bakery, but at what point in your mind did you think, okay, I think I'm ready to take this leap and do this?
You know, so it took me about like at least a year to get comfortable with what I was doing at Daniel, to find my style first, find my style of plated dessert. And like after a year, 4, 5, I was hungry for something else. I wanted to do something else. I remember actually going to see Daniel and talking to him about what I want to do, open a bakery, and showing him the business plan. And I remember going back to him like, hey, we should talk. And I want to do something. We can do it together. He was like, no, Dominique, I'm sorry. You know, it's a little too risky. I'm not sure it's a good time.
Which is fine. I mean, probably partly because he didn't want to lose you.
I think that was the biggest thing for him.
Yeah.
I remember like, because of course he was not happy about it. And, you know, I think it was like, looking back, probably hurtful for him. You know, it was such a tight, close team. It was almost like losing a son. But, you know, he's smart. He's been nothing but supportive to me. And, you know, I will always be like grateful to have the opportunity of coming with him, to work under him, and to learn so much.
Yeah. So when you decided to start your own bakery, which you founded in 2011, Dominique Ansel Bakery, on Spring Street in Soho. First of all, how did you get the money to do it? I mean, how did you find the financing to even start a business?
So back then I was like looking for investors. I had reached out to a few people. I was talking to like 2, 3 people that were more or less serious. I had nothing. I mean, I had like, you know, a couple $1,000 of savings. So I was hoping to get an investor. And, you know, I had this meeting with my designer to see a space on Union Square. I didn't walk out. He went back to his Soho office, got off the train on Spring Street, walked by the bakery and called me with like, hey, this is the space here. This is bakery, you know, not too far from our office. It looks in pretty good shape. Like, you should check it out.
Oh, it was available for lease?
Yes, it was available for lease. It was used to
and
be...
And it had already been built out,
it
basically.
It was built out. It was like set up as a bakery. And I walk in the bakery and I fell in love. I was like, this is the place. This is like perfect. You had a little garden in the back. You know, it was not very pretty. It was not very good looking. I fixed it up. And at the time, I was dating this girl who was in Hong Kong. She was a food writer, and this girl was my girlfriend, and she became my wife. And I dragged her into New York. I said, hey, why don't you come help me open the bakery? And she had a bit of savings as well. So we put everything we had, both of us, and on the table and started this way.
Wow. So she took her money, her savings, your meager savings, and you took out a lease. And you had to take, what, a 3-year lease or 5-year lease out?
10 years lease.
10 years.
And I painted the bakery. I did some tile work because I did this when I was a kid. Electrocuted myself a few times, changing outlets. You know, cleaned the toilet, fixed the computer, and we patched it up back up. And we opened the bakery, and that's all we had. And we had 4 employees.
So this is 2011. You open this bakery up, and what did you want it to be? Did you want it to be like Patisserie Pelletier that you worked at in Paris? Did you want it to be more like Fauchon? What was your vision of what you thought it should be?
No, I wanted to be Dominique Ansel Bakery. I wanted to be my own. I have to admit, I was very innocent back then.
Yeah.
And completely unaware of what it would take to open a business. So we opened with 4 employees. We had no managers, I remember looking at a bank account. Once it was like on a business bank account, I have like $2,000 left. And I was like, how the hell are we going to make it? This is like,
yeah.
My kitchen was probably, without exaggerating, 15 feet by 10 feet.
Wow.
That was my kitchen. That was one table. And the dough sheeter was sitting on table.
And so once you were ready to open, it's just 4 of you. And it's you, your then-girlfriend, now-wife, and 2 employees baking. You're going to bake everything and run the front of the shop, sell, you know, cashier and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just 4 people total doing everything.
Yeah, that was insane.
When we come back in just a moment, things get slightly more insane when people start camping outside the bakery just to get their hands on a cronut. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. I love a good deal as much as the next guy, but it has to be easy. So when Mint Mobile said you could get wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of a 3-month plan, I was skeptical. But it turns out it really is that easy to get wireless for $15 a month. I set up my Mint Mobile account in minutes. Activating my new plan was simple. Plus, I get an amazing service for a fraction of the price other providers charge. All their plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/built. That's mintmobile.com/built. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/built. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. As a B2B marketer, you know how crowded the ad space can be. If your message isn't targeted to the right audience, it just disappears into the noise. With LinkedIn ads, you can reach the professionals who are more likely to find your ad relevant. With LinkedIn's targeting capabilities, you can reach them by job title, industry, company, and more. Stand out with LinkedIn ads and start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. LinkedIn ads helps you build the right relationships, drive results, and reach your customers in a respectful environment. I check LinkedIn and even post on it several times a week, and I'm always blown away at the insights and ideas I learn on the platform. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/builtthis to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/builtthis. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be to be. And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to be motivated? Do you want your money to rise and grind? Do you think your money should get up and work? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is working like a dog while you can be sleeping like one and snoring like one too. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2011, and Dominique Ancel is just about to open his first bakery in New York. But of course, there are tons of bakeries in the city, especially cupcake bakeries, because cupcakes are really big at the time. And people are telling Dominique that he should make them too.
So that was one of my pet peeves before I opened the bakery, because a lot of people were telling me to make cupcakes. They were telling me that a lot of French chefs have tried to open a bakery in New York and failed, that I shouldn't do it. They were giving me all these advices without me asking. I don't mind cupcakes. You know, I've had more bad one than good one, but I never wanted to do cupcakes.
But did you get any, you're such a small team. Did you have any press or any articles written about the bakery, or you just opened the shop up and...
So since, I was at Daniel, and Daniel, of course, is a star with all the media,
right,
in New York and in the US as well. People pay attention because I came from Daniel. I worked for Daniel for so many years, and people want to see what I do. So, of course, it's one of the first things that Daniel told me when I left. He said, remember, whatever you do, my name is attached to yours now. So you better do well. And I kind of smirk when he said that, but now I see it and now I understand it. And so we had the New York Times, Florence Fabricant, that came to the bakery before we opened, asking questions, see what I was going to do. And she came back after we opened as well to taste the food. And she, she loved it.
Yeah.
So she wrote this beautiful piece on the New York Times. And I remember right after that, we were busy-ish, not too crazy in the beginning after the New York Times article. I think it was 2 weeks after we opened. We were slammed every single day. It was like madness.
After her article came out?
Yeah, I didn't realize the impact.
Oh, she's a massive deal. I mean, she's like an old school New York Times food writer and has been there for a long time.
She's brilliant. Knowledgeable about food. She's smart, and I understand why people read her and why people follow her.
So tell me about your average day at that time. You would get to the bakery at 3 a.m. because you got to start the process of making the dough and proofing it.
Exactly. So get there at 3 a.m, start mixing the dough, laminate the dough. So that would be for the next day.
Laminate means put the sheets of butter on, fold it.
Exactly. Folds, getting everything cut and ready. Then at 8 o'clock, I will go to the service station. We have a little service station there where we do all the made-to-order egg sandwich and stuff like this for breakfast. So we'll help with that. And then I'll go back and prepare the pastries for the day. Everything was baked before opening or right at opening.
Yeah.
The Kunyaman as well. Kunyaman is one of our best sellers.
It's your that caramelized, sugary, croissant-like little roll.
Yeah. Oh my God, yes, it's divine. It's like a flaky caramelized croissant,
yes.
Crunchy on the outside, like chewy and tender in the center. That was one of our specialty.
And all right, so those are ready by, so the pastry is ready by 11. And then tell me about the rest of the day at the bakery.
The rest of the day, I would prepare all the pastries, put everything out by 11 o'clock, and 11:30 start service. So we're doing all the sandwiches made to order, all the salad, soup, everything for lunch. By 2:30, I was done. I'll go back to the kitchen, start prepping for the next day.
Oh, wow.
It was a little bit too much in the beginning, but it was, looking back, it was fun. It was I was excited to share. I was excited to show what I could do, that I didn't want to stop. I want to do more.
Yeah. And what time did you get home?
So we closed the shop at 8 o'clock, and then I had no dishwasher at the time, so I wash all the dishes, take out the trash, sweep out the floor, mop the floor. I would go home between 10 and 11 p.m.
So wait, you would sleep for 3, maybe 4 hours a night?
Yeah, that was, I had no choice. I had so much work to do.
How long did you do that for?
I think I did this for probably 3, almost 4 years.
Wow.
That was a lot.
I mean, how did you manage your health? I mean, that's just unhealthy.
It is unhealthy. I don't suggest anyone to do that. I had no choice.
Yeah.
I had the stamina, the determination, and I don't give up and I stay positive. So we had nothing but my determination and me fighting every single day to make it work.
Were you profitable from the beginning?
No, not at all.
No.
No, we lost money. We lost a lot of money in the beginning.
What were you losing money on? Because, I mean, was it just the cost of ingredients? I mean, you had very few employees.
We were losing money on everything. Not so much the cost of goods. You have to build inventory, which I never thought of. You know, think about building inventory. It costs money. Staff, insurance, benefits, all the stuff added. Rent, when it comes in. Packaging, we start investing packaging, like, oh my God, like we're just like bleeding money for like months before we like could make it a little bit.
You were still pretty young doing this. I mean, you were like 35, 34, 35. But I mean, you'd gone from being the head pastry chef at a Michelin 3-star restaurant with the attention that comes with that and the prestige to sleeping 3 hours a night and sweeping the floors and mopping the floors and doing the dishes and like kind of like what you were doing 15 years earlier. Were there any moments where you're like, oh, what have I done?
No. No, because when it's your own, you fight with everything you have. You know, I was living very humbly. I didn't have many expenses. I have no kids. You know, I was like living with my girlfriend at the time. It's risky, but I knew eventually it was going to work. We just had to find the right pattern, like, you know, even like how much you sell your pastry for. Is it like really worth it? Will people buy it if you increase your price a little bit? You know, can you start saving on costs? Like looking at all like the packaging. Like I remember calling one of my suppliers and asking him to like drop the price of the trash bag. He's like, excuse me, like it's too expensive.
Of trash bags?
Yeah, you're buying a 3-millimeter trash bag right now. That's the thickness of the trash bag. You can buy 2 millimeters,
yep,
or one. One is cheaper. I say, yes, but one would break and people would start doubling that bag.
Right.
So I wanted 2 millimeters and I want to try it.
These are the big trash bags in the back and they give in the kitchen at night. You haul those into
Yeah.
But 2 millimeters is probably thick enough that it's not going to break.
Exactly. So I switch it.
Okay.
And I look at my numbers.
Yep.
And it was like shocking. It was like over $8,000 of saving a year.
What, just for going from a 3-millimeter bag to a 2-millimeter bag, you saved $8,000 a year?
Yes.
That's like those stories that you heard about, you know, when like they remove one olive from the first class salad, you know, United saved $1 million or something.
I think the most important is to build relationship with your vendor. You know, you need to like get to know them. You need to get to know, you know, what they have to make money as well. They have to make profit. But you need a reasonable pricing and then building that relationship where when they buy, they sell you something, they sell you for the best price.
How did you get cheaper flour or cheaper butter? I mean, especially if the same suppliers are selling larger quantities to other places.
Actually, it's going to sound like crazy and kind of intuitive, but during COVID, everything gone up. All the right. pricing gone up everywhere. Right. And I decided to import my butter and my flour from France.
Wow, that's cheaper?
No, it's not cheaper. It's a lot more expensive.
Right.
But you differentiate yourself from the competition because the quality of the ingredients and the quality of the finished product is like much, much higher. Like you want to give the best to your customers and you want to get the best price possible as well.
But going back to that time when you were trying to save money, I mean, you negotiate the trash bags. What else did you negotiate to kind of lower your costs?
I think not so much negotiation, it's more doing things myself. So if the fridge will break,
yeah,
I'll fix the fridge. There's an issue with plumbing. I don't call a plumber, I fix it myself. I cannot call a plumber and pay like $1,000. I cannot call an electrician, pay like $1,000 to fix small things that sometimes like takes them a minute to fix that is small. So a lot of like, I'm going to research it. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to fix it myself.
Yeah. All right, how long, do you remember how long from the time you opened in 2011, Florence Fabricant writes a piece about you and then there's lines, you know, it gets busier, but how long did it take before you broke even, you started to hit profitability? Do you remember?
I think it took us, and we recovered our investment like very quickly because, you know, we invested so little.
Yeah.
It took us about like 4 to 5 months, I think.
It's pretty great. I mean, I've had founders on this show who have billion-dollar valued companies who still haven't broken a profit. So there you go.
Yeah, you know, when you start with so little, every dollar feels like so much money.
Yeah.
And even, spending, I remember my first check I wrote to one of my vendor for 1 month was $10,000. And I took a deep breath, my God, $10,000 for 1 month?
Yeah. All right. So you've got the bakery going. You're grinding away, working like a dog, really, every day. And then in 2013, the story I heard, is that you're thinking of a special pastry that you can make for Mother's Day. So that would be in May of 2013. And you started to think about some ideas. What were you thinking about?
To be honest, I was busy, overwhelmed every single day. And my girlfriend, again, now my wife, she was like, hey, this is something like donuts. Maybe you can make a donut for Mother's Day.
A donut.
And I laugh at her. I was like, listen, I'm French. I have no recipe for donut. And she's like, oh, come on. And I was like, no. And then she asked me again and again. She's like, come on, you're creative. You can come up with something.
But isn't a donut generally fried? I mean, yes, you can bake them, but they're fried.
Yeah, it's fried, yeah.
Okay. So, and did you have a fryer in the restaurant, in the kitchen?
Yeah, we had a little fryer, yeah.
Okay, you had a fryer, okay.
I was like, yeah, I can try, but, I really have no recipe for donuts. I can try to do something.
Right.
I loved croissant growing up, of course, like millions of croissant. And I was like, maybe we'll do something. So I decided to take those layers of a croissant, these flaky layers, and shape them as donut and fry it.
Wait, you basically took croissant dough shaped into a donut and you dropped it in the deep fryer.
The first one, yeah. And the first test were a disaster. It was bad.
Sounds delicious, actually.
It didn't work.
Fried croissant dough?
Yeah, it didn't work because, there's more to it. It's not just a croissant dough. It's a special, type of dough that resembles to a croissant, similar techniques. So you need those layers, but you need to be, you cannot be too flaky. So it's a little tricky. It took me about, 2 to 3 months to develop the recipe.
But what, when she said, hey, try a donut, I mean, you yourself said, I didn't want to do a cupcake because that's not me. A donut's also very American. It's a very American dessert.
Yeah, we want to do something for Mother's Day for the weekend. It was just for the weekend. So I tried over and over again, probably 30, 40 versions of it. And then it was getting closer. It was getting better. It was looking better.
So what were the things that you had to do to make that work?
So I had to change the type of flour I was using. I had to change the, the hydration of the dough. There's a higher hydration. So it's a little softer.
So more water in the dough.
Yeah, it's a little softer dough. So the more you add water, the more brioche you make it.
Yep.
But if you cannot make it too brioche or too flaky either, it has to be just in between. I try different type of oil to fry. I use different temperature as well for the lamination. Which is counterintuitive. It cannot be too cold. If it's too cold, it's too many layers, too flaky. So it doesn't work. And then when I was more or less satisfied with the texture, which took a while, that was the hardest part. I played a little bit with the filling and I was like, okay, let's try it. And we're like, yeah, it's good. And we remember a friend of ours was a journalist and he randomly without knowing came by the bakery. We were testing it and we're like, what are you guys doing? I'm like, oh, this thing, we're going to call it the cronut. We're going to put it on the menu this weekend. Yeah.
A cronut.
Croissant.
The donut croissant.
And it's not, it was just without exaggerating, on the table in the corner. It was like, oh, let me take a photo. Push it to the corner. He took a photo. And then he was like, cool. I'm going to write about it. I was like, okay. He put it on his blog that was Grub Street at the time.
This is Hugh Merwin, I think, right?
Yeah, it's Hugh, yeah. Yeah. And then he put his article on the blog on Grub Street at the time.
Yeah.
And then he called me the same afternoon. And I was like, hey, listen, Dominic, I think you're going to be busy this weekend. My article went viral. I was like, what? Went viral? What does that even mean? Your article went viral. He's like, well, I have over 140,000 links to my article and an increase of traffic on the website of 300%. So I think you're going to be busy this weekend. I was like, hey, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm happy. I don't know what viral means. It's just the beginning of social media. Nobody knew anything about it.
I mean, he did write in his article. I've read it. He wrote, a bold step forward for pastry. I mean, it wasn't just a little article about the cronut. He was like, he called this a bold step forward for pastry in general. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. So I'm not surprised it went viral.
Yeah, I still like people always ask me, why do you think it went viral? You can't tell. There's so many things that got attached to this idea. I think first, like, the name is cool. The simplicity of, like, when you look at it, it looks like a donut. When you hear about it, it's croissant and donut. So you can visualize it without even eating. And by day three of the article being posted, we had, I look outside and I see a line. And I see a line stretching around the corner. So I go around the corner and it's going all the way down to the block, to the end of the block. I was like, what the hell's happening? So I go count the people myself, and I count 150 people before we open the doors.
In line before you open the door to get one of these cronuts.
And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, what's going on here? And then it was just ridiculous. The line got longer and longer every single day.
I mean, if you were, I read that the first day you only had 35 for sale.
That's right.
The second 50.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably you have to make more. Once you have 150, 200, 300 people in line, I mean, those people were not going to get a cronut.
No, for sure.
Right? Like, I mean, only 50 people were going to get one.
Yeah, maybe. And we had no rules. In the beginning, people were buying a dozen, they were buying two dozen. And then we're like left with like nothing. And people were cursing at us. They were like, you know, angry. And I get it. You know, you wait in line, like you don't know if you're going to get it or not. And very early on, I decided to like actually take care of the line. Going outside, letting people how many we have left, and making sure that everyone is aware of it. So if they wanted to wait or not, they could. But it was just like insane because we couldn't make enough.
I mean, I remember this was covered on like national news in 2013. You had like cameras outside, camera crews outside the bakery.
Many, many days where I had like reporters reporting live right in front of the bakery, and I had to tell
live
them
from the Cronut Bakery.
This is madness. People were coming, fighting in line. I had to hire security to manage the line. So what happened is that people were coming at 2 o'clock in the morning because they wanted to be first in line.
They were getting there at 2 in the morning and just camping out?
At 2 o'clock in the morning. People were coming to try to like sell stuff to the line. People were like reselling pastries on the street. Like, I was overwhelmed. I didn't know how to handle this. I was like, I can't be outside and police everyone, and we need someone to help.
People were selling these on Craigslist for like $100, $200 a krona, more than that. I mean,
I know someone that bought like two kronas and they pay like $2,000 each. That's ridiculous.
It's totally. The other thing I read, which I think is amazing, is you did not allow your friends and family to cut the line and get a cronut.
Yes.
That you actually.
That's correct.
You actually were like, if you want to try it, get in line. Like your friends who were like, dude.
Yes. I lost a few friends in the process, but I wanted to be true to myself, you know. I was out of respect of people coming as early as 2 o'clock in the morning. If you want to try, you have to go in line. The funniest part, I remember this once, like this guy, it was a long line. I was at the door actually trying to help the team. This guy came from Los Angeles and told me he was this famous producer of movies. And I was like, oh, you know this movie and this movie? I was like, yeah, I love these movies. He's like, I made them. I was like, good, sir. Like, thank you very much. But the line is still right here. And he was a little bitter about it. But, you know, I was like, I can't. Like, we have to be, like, respectful of everyone waiting in line. Doesn't matter.
I love that.
It doesn't matter who you are. My family came at the time. It was, like, a coincidence. And I was supposed to spend some time with them. Of course, I spent no time with them. They want to try. I say, okay, go wait in line. And they're like, you're joking, right? Like, I'm dead serious. Please go in line if you want to try. They didn't try it, but...
So this went on for months and months and months. It's like...
This went on for years. Like, the staff was stressed out, the customers were stressed out. All I felt like, it's a nightmare.
When we come back in just a moment, as if the cronut craze were not enough, Dominique comes up with yet another viral dessert... the cookie shot. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Whether you're starting or scaling your company's security program, demonstrating top-notch security practices and establishing trust is more important than ever. Vanta automates compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more, saving you time and money while helping you build customer trust. Plus, you can streamline security reviews by automating questionnaires and demonstrating your security posture with a customer-facing trust center, all powered by Vanta AI. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. Get $1,000 off Vanta when you go to vanta.com/built. That's vanta.com/built for $1,000 off. This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform that helps entrepreneurs stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a great-looking website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time all in one place. I actually use Squarespace to build my website, guyraz.com. Squarespace made it super easy for me to organize my podcasts, videos, and images. And now you can make your own completely personalized website with Squarespace's new guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint. Choose from professional and stylish layouts that are tailored to your brand or business. Measure your end-to-end online performance with powerful website and seller analytics. Plus, checkout for your business is simple with Squarespace's powerful payment tools. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/built to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Favorite episode so far was Joel Clark and Kodiak Cakes, mostly because I like the product, but two, hearing how he stuck with it for so many years. And then when he made it big, he still gave his brother half the company back. You can tell that he is a very kind person, and it's wonderful to hear people that are kind and have a huge heart make it, and he certainly has made it.
If you want to share your favorite episode of How I Built This, record a short voice memo on your phone telling us your name, where you're from, what your favorite episode is, and why. A lot like the voice memo you just heard. And email it to us at hibt@id.wondery.com. And we'll share your favorites right here in the ad breaks and future episodes. And thanks so much. We love you guys. You're the best. And now, back to the show. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2013, and Dominique and his team are learning to cope with the soaring success of the Cronut and the nonstop feeding frenzy outside their bakery. I mean, with just that size of kitchen, I mean, was there a point where you just said, you know what, we better just only make Cronuts for the next several months, and that's it?
To answer your question, no. I always told myself very early on, I don't want my creation to kill my creativity. And I refused to turn into a corner shop and to do the only thing. A lot of people came, talked to me about like supply and demand and like how I should like, you know, capitalize on the idea and like open 100 right. corner shop. And I say no. And I say, I'm a chef. I believe in the craft. Maybe sure call me like stupid or call me like innocent, but I love what I do. I cannot, you know, I always tell people, my dad worked in a factory. I don't want to own a factory making the same thing. Every day, like, it was not a good thing, you know, until someone, you know, reached out to me on Twitter, and they were comparing the Cronut line to the line that people go to wait for food in New York City for, like, the food bank.
Wow.
And this is when, you know, it's when I was like, hey, wait a second, like, you're right. Maybe we can do something with this and turn into something good. So I decided very early on to be involved with a lot of charities to fight against hunger, because this is something I kind of like suffer from growing up, and to help out. So the first auction we did, we went to a charity event and we sold 12 Cronut for $100,000.
a dozen Cronuts for $100,000.
It is crazy. It sounds crazy. It's a blessing. It's beautiful. And, you know, to be a part of this, you feel like, okay, I have a bigger mission here. I have, like, there's something more I can do. And we've done it many times again, and the price went very high, and people were willing to bid, like, just to try the Cronut.
Yeah. All right. So you know, part of the frenzy of this time period, lots of people coming in saying you're doing it wrong, you got to go all Cronuts, you're being overwhelmed, and you got to bake them, and you've got angry customers and demand. There does come a pressing issue comes to your attention, which is if you don't trademark this word Cronut, you will have created this thing and you will not control it. You will not be able to use that word that you yourself started using. I guess one of your customers, a lawyer, approached you about this, right?
So that's right. So it was actually a friend of ours who was a lawyer, and she saw this very early on. I think it was day like 4 or 5. She came to the bakery. She's like, "Hey, Dominic, you should like trademark this thing, the Cronut." So she registered the trademark Cronut for me. And 3 or 4 days later, there were like 24, 25 applications from the same mark.
Wow. There are a lot of scammers who do this. They'll basically trademark something that is popular, that is invented by somebody else.
Yes.
And there were, you know, bakeries who started to use the word Cronut, or they would spell it with a K, Cronut. Mm-hmm. And you guys did go after them. I mean, again, some people might say, oh, why is, you know, this successful Dominique Ancel going after these little guys? But you also, first of all, were not you were a small business.
We're small too.
But the second thing is that you felt like there'd be brand confusion, that people would be thinking, wait, this Cronut I've been hearing about in New York, I'm eating it right now. It's not that great, but they might not know that it's, like, they might associate or think it's the same.
Exactly. Yeah. That's part of it as well. Brand confusion. You know, people try to make all the product out of it. People try to like resell it and make money out of it. Our intention was not to be malicious or like to stop everyone from like being creative. Our intention was to protect our mark. And yeah, once you register a mark, you have no choice. If you don't protect it, you just like essentially give up on it and you let everyone use it.
That by 2013, so by the end of that year that you introduced a Cronut, it was named again. It was named one of the 25 best inventions of the year by Time Magazine. And it was an accident, right? I mean, not an accident, but it wasn't like you were, from the story you tell, it's not like, hey, I'm going to come up with an invention that's going to revolutionize pastry that everyone's going to talk about. Like, that really wasn't how you were thinking about this initially.
No, it's absolutely not. I think it's a genuine, like, innocent, like, simple, like, you know, heartfelt, like, story. And even if you give me all the money of the world tomorrow, you cannot plan for this. You cannot expect the same, you know, kind of, like, frenzy. You cannot, like, you know, inception people into liking the idea or not. They like it or not for X, Y, Z, and again, for a million reasons, they went viral.
Yeah.
You cannot, like, give me all the money of the world and expect me to recreate something that goes viral. I have some great ideas for sure. What goes viral or not, it's at the end of the day, it's not me who decides, it's people.
Yeah, because, I mean, a couple of years later, you would introduce the cookie shot, which is basically a cookie where you could fill it up with cream or milk and have a shot and eat it. And that's very popular, but it didn't have the same virality as the Cronut.
Oh, it went viral, but I think it was like overwhelmed by the news of the Cronut. So yes, you're right. It's a chocolate chip cookie shaped as a shot glass.
It's a shot glass.
It's lined with chocolate.
Yeah.
Yes, shot glass. And we serve it warm, a warm cookie, and we pour vanilla infused milk inside the cookie. So you drink out of the cookie and then you eat the cookie.
So delicious.
So it's a fascinating idea, you know, like we created in partnership with a PR company that was launching something in South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And we brought it there. We're like, oh, it's a cool idea. Let's do it for, you know, for this event. And we're like, oh, we're just going to do it for this event. And that's it. It went viral right here and there. We had 750 people lining out outside. I was like, this is insane. Not even the Cronut that we created, something else that we're bringing.
Wow.
And the demand was so insane that we had to put it on the menu when we came back. So we were only at the time serving the cookie shot after 3 p.m.
Wow.
The reason why is because our line was so long in the morning that we couldn't have like double line and like all these lines of people coming for our pastry. So we decided to do it after, like after school snack, we decided to do it after 3 p.m.
Dominique, I want to go back to this idea of, like, I understand you did not want to be a cronut factory. And I think it speaks to your integrity. And it's a very, by the way, it's a very French and European notion of just like, look, I want to make the best product. I don't care about maximizing profits, right? But now you are in America, right? And you are an American entrepreneur. And not to say that Americans are greedy, but
I became American a few years ago. I'm very proud of it.
Right. But I mean, just from a sustainability standpoint, I mean, I imagine there were people saying to you, you have to, this is the golden ticket, Dominique. Like you struggled, you had no money, you grinded away to build this business, and now you have an opportunity to make tens of millions of dollars on this product. You need to strike while the iron is hot. And your answer was still no?
I think it's a different approach. I think you have to think of it like, can I open 100 shops tomorrow?
Yes.
And find the money for it? Easily.
Right.
Easily. Is this what I want to do today? Not necessarily. You know, I don't want to run a factory, you know, producing like a million cornet every day and ship it frozen around the world. I don't believe in that.
And I think I get it because it wouldn't be the same experience for the customer either. You did start to, with the success of the bakery, it made sense for you to open a larger facility and then starting around 2015, you decided that you will try to bring the Dominique Ansel Bakery to other locations. You opened a location in Japan, in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
In 2015. And tell me the thinking behind it, given how resistant you were to overexpand or to expand.
Well, it's different kind of expansion, right? I think the idea was to bring our New York bakery and elevate it and bring it to Japan.
Yeah.
It's like I was in love with the idea. I was like, I thought, you know, it would be like a great thing. And it was, this place was so busy. We opened with another like 750 people in line.
Wow.
There was like 5 to 6 hour wait line just to get into the bakery at opening. It was just insane.
And this was a big shop. I mean, you had 100 employees there. I mean, this begins a period where like Tokyo, 100 employees, then you open London, a bakery there, and then you would go on to you go on to Los Angeles, and then you expanded the location in New York. I mean, all of a sudden you're building an empire, whether you want to or not. Mm-hmm. How did you manage that in your head? I mean, you had the teams in New York that you could see physically, but then you had all these, now you've got employees all around the world. Was that exciting to you, or did that become overwhelming? Did that feel overwhelming?
I felt stressed out for sure. I never felt too overwhelmed. I think it's, every business has had like local partners.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do it by myself. I have an amazing team behind me, and the best person, you know, is my wife today. The one that believed in me from the beginning.
She runs the business with you.
She runs the business. She runs everything I cannot run. So she takes care, of all the business side, the legal side, the front of the house side, and every other aspect that
She's the brains. She's the brains behind the operation. You're the muscle. She's the brains.
Yeah, she's a brain and the heart. And I'm the most fortunate man in the world, you know, to have someone like this to support me.
Yeah. As you started to expand, right? So London and then Los Angeles and then a full service restaurant in Los Angeles too, and then mm-hmm. bakeries mm-hmm. in Hong Kong. First of all, how did you control quality? I mean, how could you make sure that people were going into the London shop or the LA shop or the Hong Kong shop or even the Tokyo shop and they're walking out and saying, oh, the hype is right?
We have high standard in terms of quality of production. And we have a lot of system in place to make sure we control the quality. And the team will go through a testing every single day. So they'll pick one pastry, one drink, and one other item that they will test among themselves and send a report on quality. So I can see the photo. I can just looking at a cross section of a croissant, I can tell you if it was baked properly, if it was proofed properly, if there's an issue with the baking, if there's an issue with the fermentation. And I can pinpoint this by just looking at the photo because, you know, I've been doing this my whole life. And this like system of check and balances like help us control quality at the highest level possible.
All right, let's talk about COVID, because COVID is the beginning of, I think, a sort of a retrenchment, right? Coming, COVID, a reset.
It's a reset. I call it the big reset for everyone.
Because obviously these restaurants were massively affected by the closures. And the first, I think the first closures, you decide to close the restaurant and bakery in LA. Mm-hmm. And over the next 2 years, you would begin to really close down London and then Tokyo and really just kind of make things a bit smaller, eventually Hong Kong. I wonder whether, you know, there's multiple ways, right, to think about a business. And there was a point where you had 6-7 locations around the world. And clearly, if COVID didn't happen, you might have 15 now, right? And that might be a good thing, but it also with that comes a different level of stress and a different kind of business. And it doesn't always mean it's a healthy business. Like, I think now, right now today, you are a profitable business, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're very good financially. Like, we're a profitable business. Like, we're healthy, you know. It's we still have growth, so which is good.
Yeah.
It's true, having like, you know, many different locations comes like more stress, more worry, more like, you know, diluting your time and your focus on things. Sure, but I think like every good business is, the most important is to surround yourself and build yourself a team. You can't do it alone, no matter what. Yeah. From day one, you know, I couldn't do it alone. I thought I could do it alone. I would have never make it, you know, without my partner, without my wife.
Today, you've got two locations in New York, one in Las Vegas, and it's a obviously you've got a mail order business. When you think about where you are and where you started, working class family, you know, not a family that, you know, not a life where you were going to imagine being in New York, being a famous pastry chef. You built this amazing brand, and I wonder how much of where you are today you attribute to just the hard work you put in, which was really hard, 3 a.m. until 11 p.m. for years. And how much of what happened do you think happened because you got lucky? You just, it was luck and chance and fate.
I mean, I think luck is part of it, for sure. It's not the main thing. I mean, you have to try. You have to dare. Like, someone asked me once, would you have done this if you were in France? I told them, probably not.
Yeah.
New York is a very open-minded city that would like to explore. So long you give them good food at a fair price and you respect your customers, like, they will come back to you. They will let you try. They will give you a chance. I don't think I would have done this in France. Yeah, I was lucky. I was lucky. I thought of the idea. I was lucky. I tried. I was lucky. I worked hard for it. I was lucky. I met my wife. I was lucky for a lot of things. Sure, you can say that. I also worked really hard for it. And luck is a part of it. Yes, but I think that if you're a good person in life, you attract good people around you and good things happen to you.
That's Dominique Ancel, founder of Dominique Ancel Bakery. By the way, Dominique is still tinkering with new ideas in his bakery every day, including one that has kind of a Willy Wonka feel.
I want people to eat desserts like with like zero gravity.
You want people to eat desserts in zero gravity, or you want people to feel like they are in zero gravity when they eat your dessert?
Oh, no, I want them to be in zero gravity in desserts.
Oh, in space somehow, or like on a...
Maybe not in space.
But on an airplane that just dives and you go into zero gravity.
Yeah.
Or cookie shots. But the milk from the cookie shot's going to be coming out of the cookie. It's in zero gravity.
Oh, don't... You see, like, you have to think differently. It'll be by the time you build that zero gravity chamber, I will have created like a lot of ideas of desserts that you can think of eating yet.
Like a marshmallowy thing that comes out and you can just like eat it in zero gravity as it floats out.
I got you excited with the idea.
I'm in. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Please make sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss a new episode of the show. And as always, it's free. And don't forget to sign up for my free newsletter at guyraz.com. It's full of insights and ideas from some of the world's greatest entrepreneurs. This episode was produced by Carla Estevez with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Catherine Seifer and audio engineering by Robert Rodriguez and Kwesi Lee. Our production staff also includes Casey Herman, JC Howard, Alex Chung, John Isabella, Elaine Coates, Carrie Thompson, and Chris Messini. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above-and-beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.